She found our hypocrisy, Mikkel, our double-dealing. And that's why I'm sitting here with you and not on my fat ass in Maryland, sending the Marines after her. She was like a thief breaking into a house just to point out that it was already full of stolen goods, and the minute we found that out, she became truly dangerous. So dangerous that some of our senior people wanted to let her off. But not you. Not me. I wanted to tie her to a lamppost and flay her alive. But I had no choice except to give up my pursuit, and that, Mikkel, seriously pissed me off. I may look calm now, but you should have seen me. Jesus! You were hopping mad. Damn right. And that's why I had you come here at this godforsaken hour. I need to get hold of Wasp before she flees the country. Why would she run? Because she went from one crazy thing to the next, didn't she? I don't know. I think you do. What makes you so sure she's your hacker in the first place? That, Mikkel, is what I'm going to lay on you now. But he got no further. The room telephone rang and Needham picked up right away. It was reception looking for Mikkel Blomkvist, and Needham handed him the receiver. He soon gathered that the journalist had been given some alarming news, so it was no surprise when the Swede muttered a confused apology and ran out of the room. But Needham would not let him get away that easily. He grabbed his coat and chased after him. Blomkvist was racing down the corridor like a sprinter. Needham did not know what was going on, but if it had something to do with the Wasp-Balder story, he wanted to be there. He had some trouble keeping up. The journalist was in too much of a hurry to wait for the lift, and instead hurtled down the stairs. By the time Needham reached the ground floor, panting, Blomkvist had already retrieved his mobiles and was engrossed in another conversation while he ran on towards the revolving doors and out into the street. "What's happening?" Needham said as the journalist ended his call and tried to hail a taxi further down the street. "Problems," Blomkvist said. "I can drive you." "Like hell you can. You've been drinking. At least we can take my car." Blomkvist slowed his pace and turned to Needham. "What is it you want?" "I want us to help each other." "You'll have to catch your hacker on your own. I no longer have the authority to catch anybody." "Okay. So where's the car?" As they ran to Needham's rental car, parked over by the National Museum, Blomkvist hurriedly explained that they were heading out to the Stockholm archipelago, towards Ingeru. He would get directions on the way, and was not planning to observe any speed limits.
Chapter 26 November 24th. Morning. August screamed, and in the same instant Salander heard rapid footsteps along the side of the house. She grabbed her pistol and jumped to her feet. She felt terrible, but ignored it. As she rushed over to the doorway, she saw a large man appear on the terrace. She thought she had a split-second advantage, but the figure did not stop to open the glass doors. He charged straight through them, with his weapon drawn, and shot at the boy. Salander returned fire, or perhaps she had already done so. She did not know. She was not even conscious of the moment in which she started running towards the man. She only knew that she had crashed into him with a numbing force, and now lay on top of him right by the round table where the boy had been sitting moments before. Without hesitation, she head-butted the man. The contact was so violent that her skull rang, and she swayed as she got to her feet. The room was spinning, and there was blood on her shirt. Had she been hit again? She had no time to think. Where was August? No one at the table. Only pencils and drawings, crayons, prime number calculations. Where the hell was he? She heard a whimpering by the refrigerator, and yes, there he was, sitting and shaking, his knees drawn up to his chest. He must have had time to throw himself to the floor. Salander was about to rush over to him when she heard new, worrying sounds from outside, voices and branches snapping. Others were approaching. There was no time to lose. In a blinding flash, she visualized the surrounding terrain and raced over to August.
"Come on,"
she said. August did not budge. Salander picked him up, her face twisted in pain. Every movement hurt. But they had to get away, and August must have understood that, too, because he wriggled out of her grasp and ran alongside her. She sprang over to the table, grabbed her computer and made for the terrace, past the man on the floor, who raised himself groggily and tried to catch hold of August's leg. Salander considered killing him. Instead, she kicked him hard in the throat and stomach and threw away his weapon. Then she ran across the terrace with August and down towards the steep, rocky slope. But suddenly she thought of the drawing. She had not seen how much progress August had made. Should she turn around? No, the others would be here any moment. They had to get away. But still, the drawing was also a weapon, and the cause of all this madness. She left August with her computer on the rock ledge she had identified the night before. She then launched herself back up the slope and into the house and looked on the table, and at first she could not see it. Drawings of that bastard Vestman were everywhere, and rows of prime numbers. But there it was, and above the chess squares and the mirrors there was now a pale figure with a sharply defined scar on his forehead, which Salander by now recognized only too well. It was the same man who was lying on the floor in front of her, moaning. She whipped out her mobile, took a photo, and sent it to Boblansky and Murdick. She had even scribbled a line at the top of the paper. But a second later she realized that was a mistake. They were surrounded. Salander had sent the same word to Blomqvist's Samsung as she had to Beria, crisis. It hardly left room for misunderstanding, not coming from Salander. However he looked at it, it could only mean that she and August had been discovered, and at worst they were under attack even now. He floored the accelerator as he passed Stadskorskarjen and emerged onto the Vernde Road. He was driving a new silver Audi A8 with Needham sitting next to him. Needham looked grim and every now and then tapped something into his mobile. Blomqvist was not sure why he had allowed him to come along. Maybe he wanted to discover what the man had on Salander. Or, no, there was something else as well. Maybe Needham could even be useful. In any case, he could hardly make the situation worse. The police had by now been alerted, but he doubted they would be able to assemble a unit quickly enough, especially as they were skeptical about the lack of information. Beria had been the focal point, trying to keep them all in contact with each other, and she was the only one who knew the way. He needed all the help he could get. He was approaching Danviksbron. Needham said something. He did not hear what. His thoughts were elsewhere. He thought of Xander. What had they done to him? Why the hell had he not come along for a beer? Blomqvist tried his number again. He tried calling Salander too, but nobody answered.
"Do you want me to tell you what we have on your hacker?" Needham said.
"Yes, why not?"
But they did not get anywhere this time either. Blomqvist's mobile rang. Boblansky.
"I hope you realize that you and I are going to have a lot to talk about later, and you can count on there being legal consequences."
"I understand. But for now I'm calling to give you some information. We know that Lisbeth Salander was alive at 4:22. Was that before or after she texted you?"
"Before, just before."
"Okay.
How can you be so specific about the time? She sent us something extremely interesting, a drawing.
I have to say, Mikael, it exceeded our hopes."
"So she was able to get the boy to draw?"
"Oh, yes. I have no idea what technical issues, if any, might arise in terms of admissibility of evidence, or what objections a clever defense lawyer might raise. But as far as I'm concerned, there's no doubt this is the murderer. The drawing is incredibly vivid, with that extraordinary mathematical precision again. In fact, there's also an equation written at the bottom of the page. I have no idea if it's relevant to the case, but I sent the drawing to Interpol. If the man is anywhere in their database, he's toast."
"Are you going to send it to the press as well?"
"We're debating that."
"When will you be at the scene?"
"As soon as possible.
Hold on a second."
Blomqvist could hear another telephone ringing in the background, and for a minute or so Boblansky was gone on another call. When he returned, he said briefly,
"We've had reports of gunfire out there. It doesn't sound good."
Blomqvist took a deep breath.
"Any news on Andre?" he said.
"We've traced his mobile signal to a base station in Gamlestan, but no further. We've had no signal at all for a while now, as if the mobile had been smashed or just stopped working."
Blomqvist drove even faster. Fortunately, the roads were empty at that hour. At first he said very little to Needham, just a brief account of what was going on, but in the end he could not hold back. He needed something else to think about.
"Will you tell me what you found out?"
"About Wasp? For a long time, zip.
"We were convinced we'd reached the end of the line," Needham said. "We'd left no stone unturned, and still got nowhere. In a way, it made sense."
"How so?"
"A hacker capable of a breach like that should also be able to cover all tracks. I realized we wouldn't get anywhere by conventional means, so I skipped the forensic bullshit and went straight for the big question. Who had the chops to pull this off? That question was our best hope. There's hardly anyone out there with that level of ability. In that sense, you could say that the hacker's skill worked against them. Plus, we had analyzed the rootkit itself, and..."
Needham looked down at his mobile.
"Yes?"
"It had artistic qualities. Personal style, you might say. Now we just had to find its author, and so we started to send posts to the hacker community. There was one name, one handle, which came up time after time. Can you guess which one?"
"Maybe."
"It was Wasp. Sure, there were other names, but Wasp stood out. I ended up hearing so much mythical bullshit about this person that I was dying to crack their identity. We read every word Wasp had written online, studied every operation that had Wasp's signature on it. Soon we were certain that Wasp was a woman, and we guessed that she was Swedish. Several of the early posts were written in Swedish, which isn't much to go on. But since there was a Swedish connection in the organization she was tracking, and Franz Balder was Swedish, it was at least a place to start. I got in touch with the NDRE, and they searched their records. And then, in fact,
what?
They had a breakthrough. Many years earlier, they investigated a hacker operation that used that very handle, Wasp. It was so long ago that Wasp wasn't even particularly good at encryption yet.
What happened?
Wasp had been looking for data on individuals who defected from other countries' intelligence services, and that was enough to trigger the NDRE's warning system. Their investigation led them to a psychiatric clinic for children in Uppsala, to a computer belonging to the head physician there, a man named Teleborian. Apparently he'd done some work for the Swedish security police, so he was above suspicion. Instead, the NDRE concentrated on some mental health nurses who were targeted because they were, well, to be blunt about it, immigrants. It was such a stupid strategy. Anyway, nothing came of it.
I can imagine.
So I asked a guy at the NDRE to send over all the old material, and we sifted through it with a different mindset. You know, you don't have to be big and fat and shave in the mornings to be a good hacker. I've met 12 and 13-year-olds who are crazy good. It was obvious to me that we should look at every child in the clinic at the time. I had three of my guys investigate each one of them, inside and out, and do you know what we found? One of the children was the daughter of former spy and arch-villain Zalichenko, who was known to our colleagues at the CIA. Then everything got really interesting. As you probably know, there are some overlaps between the network the hacker was investigating and Zalichenko's old crime syndicate.
That doesn't necessarily mean it was Wasp who hacked you.
Of course not. But we took a closer look at this girl. And what can I say? She has an interesting background, doesn't she? A lot of information about her in the public record has been mysteriously deleted, but we still found more than enough, and... I don't know. I could be wrong, but I get the feeling we're on the right track. Mikael, you don't know shit about me, but I know what it's like for a kid to see extreme violence at close quarters, and I know what it's like when society doesn't lift a finger to punish the guilty. It hurts like hell, and I'm not at all surprised that most children who experience it go under. They turn into destructive bastards themselves.
Yes, unfortunately.
But just a few grow to be as strong as bears, Miko, and they stand up and fight back. Wasp was one of those, wasn't she?
Blomqvist nodded pensively and pressed down on the accelerator a little more.
They locked her up and kept trying to break her, but she kept coming back, and you know what I think?
No.
She got stronger each time. She became positively lethal. I bet she hasn't forgotten a single thing that happened. It's all etched into her, isn't it? And maybe that's at the bottom of this whole goddamn mess.
You still haven't told me what you want, Blomqvist said bluntly.
I want what Wasp wants. I want to set some things right.
And get your hands on the hacker.
I want to meet her, and give her a piece of my mind and plug every last damn hole in our security. But above all, I want to retaliate against certain people who wouldn't let me finish my job because Wasp exposed them. I have reason to believe you're going to help me with that.
Why?
Because you're a good reporter. Good reporters don't want dirty secrets to go on being dirty secrets.
And Wasp? Wasp is going to get a chance to do her worst. You're going to help me with that, too.
Or else?
Or else I'll find a way of putting her inside, and making her life hell again, I swear.
But for now all you want to do is talk to her?
No fucker is going to be allowed to hack into my system again, so I need to understand exactly how she did it. I want you to give her that message. I'm prepared to let your girlfriend go free if she'll sit down with me and explain.
I'll tell her.
Let's just hope that she's still alive,
Needham said. They turned left at high speed, in the direction of Ingerustrand. It was rare for Holzer to get things so wrong. He had this romantic delusion that you could tell from a distance if a man was likely to succeed in close combat. That was why he had not been surprised when Kira's attempted seduction of Blomqvist had failed. Orlov and Bogdanov had been completely confident, but Holzer had had his doubts, having seen the journalist for only one giddy second in Sorchevarden. Blomqvist looked like a problem. He looked like a man who could not be fooled or broken so easily. With the younger journalist, it was different. He looked like the archetypal weakling. Yet nothing could have been further from the truth. Xander had resisted for longer than anyone Holzer had ever tortured. Despite excruciating pain, he had refused to break. His eyes shone with a grim determination, which seemed buttressed by a higher principle, and at one point Holzer thought they would have to give up, that Xander would rather endure any suffering than talk. It was not until Kira solemnly promised that both Beria and Blomqvist from Millennium would be made to suffer the same that Xander finally caved. By then it was 3:30 in the morning. Holzer knew that he would always remember the moment. Snow was falling over the skylights. The young man's face was dried out and hollow-eyed. Blood had splashed up from his chest and flecked his mouth and cheeks. His lips, which for a long time had been covered with tape, were split and oozing. He was a wreck. But still you could tell that he was a beautiful young man. Holzer thought of Olga. How would she have felt about him? Wasn't this journalist just the kind of educated man she liked? Someone who fights injustice, takes the side of beggars and outcasts? He thought about that, and about other things in his own life. After that he made the sign of the cross, the Russian cross, where one way leads to heaven and the other to hell, and then he glanced over at Kira. She was lovelier than ever. Her eyes burned with light. She was sitting on a stool by the bed, wearing an elegant blue dress, which had largely escaped the bloodstains, and said something in Swedish to Xander, something which sounded soft and tender. Then she took him by the hand. He gripped hers in return. He had nowhere else to turn for comfort. The wind howled outside in the alley. Kira nodded and smiled at Holzer. Snowflakes fell on the window ledge. Afterwards they were sitting together in a Land Rover on the way out to Ingaru. Holzer felt empty and was not happy with the way things were going, but there was no getting away from the fact that his own mistake had led them there, so he sat quietly, listening to Kira. She was strangely excited and spoke with searing hatred of the woman they were about to confront. Holzer did not think it was a good sign, and if he could have brought himself to do so he would have urged her to turn back and get the hell out of the country. But he said nothing. As they drove on in the darkness, Kira's sparkling, cold eyes frightened him, but he pushed away the thought. He had to at least give her credit. She had been amazingly quick to put two and two together. Not only had she worked out who had hurtled in to save the boy on Sveavägen, she had also guessed who would know where the boy and the woman had disappeared to. And the person she came up with was none other than Mikael Blomqvist. They were baffled by her reasoning. Why would a reputable Swedish journalist harbour a person who appeared from nowhere and abducted a child from a crime scene? But the more they examined the theory, the more it held together. Not only did the woman, whose name was Lisbeth Salander, have close ties to the reporter, but something also happened at the Millennium offices. After the murder in Sorchevarden, Bogdanov had hacked into Blomqvist's computer to try to find out why Balder had summoned him to his home in the middle of the night. Getting access to his email had been easy enough, but that now stopped. When was the last time it had been impossible for Bogdanov to read someone's emails? Never, so far as Holzer was aware. Blomqvist had suddenly become much more careful, right after the woman and the boy disappeared from Sveavägen. That in itself was no guarantee that the journalist knew where they now were. But as time went on, there were more indications that the theory might be right, and in any case Kiri did not seem to need ironclad evidence. She wanted to go for Blomqvist, or, if not him, then someone else at the magazine. More than anything, she was obsessive in her determination to track down the woman and the child. Maybe Hodso could not understand the subtleties of Kira's motives, but it was for his benefit that they were going to do away with the boy. Kira chose to take significant risks for Holzer, and he was grateful. He really was, even though now in the car he felt uneasy. He tried to draw strength from thinking about Olga. Whatever happened, she must not wake up and see a drawing of her father on all the front pages. He tried to reassure himself that the hardest part was behind them. Assuming Xander had given them the right address, the job should be straightforward. They were three heavily armed men, four if you counted Bogdanov, who spent most of the time staring at his computer as usual. The team consisted of Holzer, Bogdanov, Orlov, and Dennis Wilton, a gangster who had been a member of Savosher MC, but now worked for Kira. Four men against one woman who was probably asleep, and was also protecting a child. It shouldn't be a problem. Not at all. But Kira was almost manic.
"Don't underestimate Xalander."
She said it so many times that even Bogdanov, who always agreed with everything she said, began to get irritated. Of course, Holzer had seen how fit and fast and fearless the woman had been on Sveavägen, but the way Kira described her, she must be some kind of superwoman. It was ridiculous. Holzer had never met a woman who could remotely match him or even Orlov in combat. Still, he promised to be careful. First he would go up and check out the terrain and prepare a strategy. They would not be drawn into a trap. He stressed this many times over, and when finally they arrived at an inlet next to a rocky slope and a jetty, he took command. He told the others to get ready in the shelter of the car while he went ahead to locate the house. Holzer liked early mornings. He liked the silence and the feeling of transition in the air. Now he was walking along, leaning forward and listening. It was reassuringly dark. No lights were on. He left the jetty behind him and came to a wooden fence with a rickety gate, next to an overgrown prickly bush. He opened the gate and started to climb steep wooden stairs, holding the handrail on the right. Soon he was able to make out the house above. It lay hidden behind pine trees and aspens, and was only a dark outline with a terrace on the south side. On the terrace were some glass doors which they would have no trouble breaking through. At first he saw no major difficulties. He was moving almost soundlessly, and for a moment he considered finishing off the job himself. Maybe it was even his moral responsibility. It should be no more difficult than other jobs he had done. On the contrary. There were no policemen this time, no guards, nor any sign of an alarm system. True, he did not have his assault rifle with him, but then there was no need for it. The rifle was excessive, the result of Kira's heated imagination. He had his pistol, his Remington, and that was more than enough. Suddenly, without his usual careful planning, he started moving along the side of the house, up to the terrace and the glass doors. Then he stiffened, without at first knowing why. It could have been a sound, a movement, a danger he had only half sensed. He looked up at the rectangular window above him, but from his position he could not see into it. He kept still, now less and less sure of himself. Could it be the wrong house? He resolved to get closer and peer in, and then he was transfixed in the darkness. He was being observed. Those eyes which once before had looked at him were now staring glassily in his direction. That is when he should have reacted. He should have sprinted around to the terrace, gone straight in, and shot the boy. But again he hesitated. He could not bring himself to draw his weapon. Faced with that look, he was lost. The boy let out a shrill scream which seemed to set the window vibrating, and only then did Holzer tear himself out of his paralysis and race up to the terrace. Without a moment's reflection, he hurtled straight through the glass doors and fired with what he thought was great precision, but he never found out whether he hit his target. An explosive shadow-like figure came at him with such speed that he hardly had time to brace himself. He knew that he fired another shot and that someone shot back. In the next instant he slammed onto the floor with his full weight, a young woman tumbling over him with a rage in her eyes that was beyond anything he had ever seen. He reacted instinctively and tried to shoot again, but the woman was like a wild animal. She threw her head back and crack! When he came to, he had a taste of blood in his mouth, and his pullover was sticky and wet. He must have been hit. Just then the boy and the woman passed him, and he tried to grab hold of the boy's leg. At least he thought he did, but suddenly he was gasping for breath. He no longer understood what was going on, except that he was beaten, and by whom? By a woman. That insight became a part of his pain as he lay on the floor, amid broken glass and his own blood, breathing heavily, his eyes shut. He hoped it would be over soon. When he opened his eyes again, he was surprised to see the woman still there. Had she not just left? No, she was standing by the table. He could see her thin, boyish legs. He tried his utmost to get up. He looked for his weapon and at the same time caught a glimpse of Orlov through the window. He moved once more to attack the woman. But before he could do anything, the woman grabbed some papers and stormed out. From the terrace she threw herself headlong into the trees. Shots resounded in the dark, and he muttered to himself, "Kill the bastards!" But it was all he could do to get to his feet, and he cast a dull glance at the table in front of him. There was a mass of crayons and paper which he looked at without really focusing. Then it was as if a claw took hold of his heart. He saw an evil demon with a pale face raising his hand to kill. It took a second or so for him to realize that the demon was himself, and he shuddered. Yet he could not take his eyes off the image. Only then did he notice something scribbled at the top. Mailed to police, 422. Chapter 27. November 24th. Morning. When Aram Barzani of the Rapid Response Unit made his way into Gabriele Grana's house at 4:52, he saw a large man dressed in black spread-eagled on the floor next to the round table. He approached cautiously. The house seemed to have been abandoned, but he was not taking any risks. There were recent reports of a fierce gunfight up at the house, and he could hear the excited voices of his colleagues outside on the steep rock slope.
"Here!"
they shouted.
"Here!"
Barzani did not understand what was going on, and for a moment he hesitated. Should he go to them? He decided to first see what condition the man on the floor was in. Broken glass and blood lay all around, and the table was strewn with torn-up pieces of paper and crushed crayons. The man on the ground was crossing himself feebly. He was mumbling something, probably a prayer. It sounded Russian. Barzani caught the word Olga. He told the man that a medical team was on its way.
"They were sisters,"
the man said in English. But it sounded so confused that Barzani attached no importance to it. Instead, he searched through the man's clothes, made sure that he was unarmed, and thought he had probably been shot in the stomach. His pullover was soaked in blood, and he looked alarmingly pale. Barzani asked what had happened. He got no reply, not at first. Then the man gasped out another strange sentence.
"My soul was captured in a drawing," he said,
and seemed to be about to lose consciousness. Barzani stayed for a few minutes to watch him, but when he heard from the ambulance crew, he left the man and went down to the rocky slope. He wanted to discover what his colleagues had been shouting about. The snow was still falling, and it was icy underfoot. Down by the water, voices could be heard, and the sound of more cars arriving. It was still dark and hard to see, and there were many uneven rocks and straggly pines. The landscape was dramatic and steep. It could not have been easy to fight in this terrain, and Barzani was gripped with foreboding. He noticed that it had become strangely quiet. But his team members were not far away, behind an overgrown aspen. He felt afraid. A rare occurrence for him when he saw them staring down at the ground. What had they seen? Was the autistic boy dead? He walked over slowly, thinking about his own boys, 6 and 9 now. They were crazy about football, did nothing else, talked about nothing else, Björn and Anders. He and Dilvan had given them Swedish names because they thought it would make their lives easier. What kind of people come out here to kill a child? He was gripped by a sudden fury, but in the next moment he breathed a sigh of relief. There was no boy there, but two men lying on the ground, apparently both shot in the stomach. One of them, a brutal-looking type with pockmarked skin and a stubby boxer's nose, tried to get up, but was pushed down again. His face betrayed his humiliation, and his right hand was shaking with pain or rage. The other man, who was wearing a leather jacket and had his hair in a ponytail, seemed in worse shape. He lay still and stared in shock at the dark sky.
"No evidence of the child?" Barzani said.
"Nothing," his colleague, Klaus Lang, answered.
"And the woman?"
"No sign of her." Barzani was not sure if this was good news, and he asked a few more questions, but no one knew what had happened. The only certainty was that two automatic weapons, Barrett REC-7s, had been found 30 or 40 yards away towards the jetty. They were assumed to belong to the men,
but when asked how they had ended up there, the man with a pockmarked face spat out an incomprehensible answer.
Barzani and his colleagues spent the next 15 minutes combing the terrain. All they could find were further signs of combat. More and more people began to arrive on the scene. Ambulance crew, Detective Sergeant Modig, 2 or 3 crime scene technicians, a succession of regular policemen, and the journalist Mikael Blomqvist, who was accompanied by a massive American with a crew cut, who immediately commanded everyone's respect. At 5:25, they were informed that a witness was waiting to be interviewed, down by the seashore and parking area. The man wanted to be addressed as K.G. He was actually called Carl Gustav Mattsson. He had recently bought a new build on the other side of the water.
According to Lang, he needed to be taken with a grain of salt.
"The old boy has a very vivid imagination."
Modig and Holmberry were standing in the parking area trying to make sense of what had happened. The picture so far was fragmented, and they were hoping that the witness, K.G. Mattsson, would bring a measure of clarity to the night. But when they saw him coming towards them along the shoreline, that seemed less and less likely. K.G. Mattsson was resplendent in a Tyrolean hat, green-checked trousers, and a red Canada Goose jacket, and he was sporting an absurd twirly moustache. He looked as if he were trying to be funny.
"K.G. Mattsson?" Modig asked. "The very same," he said,
and without any prompting, maybe he realized that his credibility needed a boost, he explained that he ran True Crimes, a publishing house which produced books on notable crimes.
"Excellent, but right now we'd like a factual account, not some sales pitch for a forthcoming book," Modig said, to be on the safe side.
Mattsson said of course he understood. He was, after all, a respectable person. He had woken up at a ridiculous hour, he said, and lain there listening to The Silence and the Calm. But just before 4:30, he heard something which he immediately recognized as a pistol shot, so he quickly got dressed and went on to his terrace, which had a view of the beach, the rock promontory, and the parking area where they were now standing.
"What did you see?"
"Nothing. It was eerily quiet. Then the air exploded. It sounded as if a war had broken out."
"You heard more shots?"
"There were cracks of gunfire from the promontory on the other side of the inlet, and I stared across, stunned. And then... did I mention I was a bird watcher?"
"No, you didn't."
"Well, it's made my eyesight very good, you see. I've got eagle eyes. I'm used to pinpointing tiny details far off, and I'm sure that's why I noticed a small dot on the rock ledge up there. Do you see it? The edge of it sort of cuts into the slope like a pocket."
Modig looked up at the slope and nodded.
"At first I couldn't tell what it was," Mattsson continued. "But then I realized it was a child, a boy, I think. He was sitting up there in a crouch and trembling. At least, that's how it seemed to me. And then suddenly... my God, I'll never forget it."
"What?"
"Someone came racing down from above, a woman, and she leaped into the air and landed so violently on the rock ledge that she all but fell off it. After that, they sat there together, she and the boy, and just waited. Waited for the inevitable. And then... yes, 2 men appeared holding assault rifles and shot and shot. As I'm sure you can imagine, I threw myself to the ground. I was scared I'd get hit. But I couldn't help looking up at them all the same. You see, from where I was, the boy and the girl were clearly visible, but they were invisible to the men standing at the top, at least for the moment. It was obvious to me that it was only a matter of time before they were discovered, and there was no escape. As soon as they left the rock ledge, the men would see them and kill them. It was a hopeless situation."
"But we found neither the boy nor the woman up there," Modig said.
"That's just it. The men got closer and closer. They only needed to lean forward to see the woman and the child. In the end, they could probably have heard them breathing. But then..."
"Yes?"
"You're not going to believe this. That man from the rapid response unit definitely didn't."
Well, go ahead and tell me, and we can worry later about whether it's believable.
When the men stopped to listen, maybe they sensed they were very close, the woman leaped to her feet and shot them. Bang, bang! Then she rushed forward and threw their weapons away. It was like an action film. And after that she ran, or rather rolled, almost fell down the slope with the boy, to a BMW standing here in the parking area. Just before they got into the car, I saw that the woman was holding something. It looked like a computer bag.
Did they drive off in the BMW?
At a fearful speed. I have no idea where they went.
Okay.
But that's not all.
What do you mean?
There was another car there, a Range Rover, I think. Black. A new model.
And what happened to that one?
I was busy ringing the emergency services, but just as I was about to hang up, I saw two more people coming down from the wooden stairs over there, a tall, skinny man and a woman. I didn't get a good look at them from that distance, but I can tell you two things about that woman.
Yes?
She was a 12-pointer, and she was angry.
12-pointer meaning beautiful?
Or at least glamorous, classy. You could see it a mile off. But boy, was she furious. Just before they got into the Range Rover, she slapped the man, and the weird thing is, he hardly reacted. He just nodded as if he thought he deserved it. Then he got behind the wheel, and they were gone.
Modig noted everything down, realizing that she had to get out a nationwide search bulletin for both the Range Rover and the BMW without delay. Gabriella Grana was drinking a cappuccino in her kitchen on Villegarten and thinking that she was holding it together, all things considered, but she was probably in shock. Helena Kraft wanted to see her at 8 a.m. in her office at Seppo. Grana guessed that she wouldn't just get the sack. There would be judicial consequences, too, which would pretty much ruin her prospects of finding another job. At 33, her career was over. And that was by no means the worst of it. She had known that she was flouting the law and had taken a conscious risk, but she had done it because she believed it was the best way to protect Franz Balder's son. Now, after the shootout at her summer place, no one seemed to know where the boy was. He might be injured, or even dead. Grana was racked by the most devastating feelings of guilt, first the father, and then the son. She got up and looked at the clock. It was 7:15, and she needed to get going to give herself time to clean out her desk before the meeting with Kraft. She made up her mind to behave with dignity, to not make any excuses, or beg to be allowed to stay. Her black phone rang, but she couldn't be bothered to answer. Instead, she put on her boots and her Prada coat and an extravagant red scarf. If she was going under, she might as well go with a bit of panache. She stood in front of the hall mirror and touched up her makeup, Riley giving herself the victory sign, as Nixon had when he resigned. Then her black phone rang again. This time she picked up reluctantly. It was Casales at the NSA.
"I just heard," she said.
Of course she had.
"How are you feeling?"
"How do you think?"
"Like the worst person in the whole world?"
"Pretty much.
Who'll never get another job?"
"Spot on, Ilona.
In that case, let me tell you. You have nothing to be ashamed of. You did the right thing."
"Are you trying to be funny?"
"This isn't the time for jokes, sweetheart. You have a mole on your team."
Gabriella took a deep breath.
"Who is it?"
"Nielsen." Gabriella froze.
"Do you have proof?"
"Oh, yes. I'll send it all over in a few minutes."
"Why would Nielsen betray us?"
"I guess he didn't see it as a betrayal."
"What on earth did he see it as, if not betrayal?"
"Collaborating with Big Brother, maybe? Doing his duty by the leading nation in the free world? What do I know?"
"So he gave you information?"
"He helped us to help ourselves, actually. He gave us information about your server and your encryption. It's not as outrageous as it sounds. Let's face it, we listen in on everything from the neighbors' gossip to the Prime Minister's phone calls.
But this time the information was leaked a stage further. In this case, it seeped out like we were a funnel. I know, Gabriella, that you didn't exactly stick to the rule book, but I'm absolutely convinced that you were in the right, and I'll make sure your superiors get to hear it. You could see that there was something rotten in your organization, so you couldn't act within it, yet you were determined not to shirk your responsibility.
But it went wrong."
"Sometimes things go wrong, no matter how careful you are."
"Thanks, Ilona. It's nice of you to say so. But if anything has happened to August Balder, I will never forgive myself."
"Gabriella, the boy is okay. He's cruising around in a car somewhere with Miss Salander, in case someone's still chasing them.
Grana could not take it in.
What do you mean? That he's unhurt, babe, and thanks to him his father's murderer has been caught and identified. You're saying August is alive? That's right. How do you know? Let's just say I have a very well-placed source. Alona? Yes? If what you say is true, you've given me back my life.
After hanging up, Grana rang Kraft and insisted that Morten Nielsen be present at their meeting. Reluctantly, Kraft agreed. It was 7:30 in the morning when Needham and Blomqvist made their way down the steps from Grana's summer house to the Audi in the parking area by the beach. Snow lay over the landscape, and neither of them said a word. At 5:30, Blomqvist had gotten a text message from Salander, as brisk and to the point as ever. August unhurt. We'll keep our heads down a while longer. Again, Salander had not mentioned her own state of health, but it was an incredible relief to hear about the boy. Afterwards, Blomqvist had been questioned at length by Modig and Holmberry, and he told them every detail of what he and the magazine had been doing over the past few days. They were not particularly well-disposed towards him, yet he got the feeling that somehow they understood. Now, an hour later, he was walking past the jetty. Up the slope a deer scampered into the forest. Blomqvist settled into the driver's seat and waited for Needham, who came loping along in his wake. The American's back was giving him trouble. On the way towards Brunn, they found themselves in traffic. For several minutes no cars were moving, and Blomqvist thought of Xander, who was constantly on his mind. They had still not had any sign of life.
"Can you get something noisy on the radio?"
Needham said. Blomqvist tuned into 107.1 and got James Brown belting out what a sex machine he was.
"Give me your phones," Needham said.
He stacked them next to the speakers at the back of the car. He clearly meant to talk about something sensitive, and Blomqvist had nothing against that. He had to write his story and needed all the facts he could get, but he also knew better than most that there's no such thing as a leak without an agenda. Although Blomqvist felt a certain affinity with Needham, and even appreciated his grumpy charm, he did not trust him for one second.
"Let's hear it," he said.
"You could put it this way," Needham began. "We know that in business and industry, there's always someone taking advantage of inside information."
"Agreed.
For a while, we were pretty much spared that in the world of intelligence, for the simple reason that we guarded different kinds of secrets. The dynamite was elsewhere. But since the end of the Cold War, that's changed. Surveillance in general has become more widespread. These days we control huge amounts of valuable material."
"And there are people taking advantage of this, you say?"
"Well, that's basically the whole point. Corporate espionage helps keep companies informed about the strengths and weaknesses of the competition. It's a grey area. Something that was seen as criminal or unethical decades ago is now standard operating procedure. We're not much better than the NSA. In fact, maybe we're even...
the worst?"
"Just take it easy, let me finish," Needham said. "I'd say we have a certain moral code, but we're a large organization with tens of thousands of employees, and inevitably there are rotten apples. One or two very highly placed rotten apples I was thinking of handing you."
"Out of the kindness of your heart, of course," said Blomqvist,
with a touch of sarcasm.
"Okay, maybe not entirely. But listen, when senior management at our place crosses the line and gets into criminal activities, what do you think happens?"
"Nothing very nice."
"As you know, there's a corrupt unit at Solifon, headed up by a man called Zygmunt Ekewald, whose job it is to find out what the competing tech companies are up to. They not only steal the technology, but also sell what they steal. That's bad for Solifon, and maybe even for the whole NASDAQ."
"And for you, too."
"That's right. It turns out that our two most senior executives in industrial espionage, their names are Jacob Barclay and Brian Abbott, get help from Ekewald and his gang. In exchange, the NSA helps Ekewald with large-scale communications monitoring. Solifon identifies where the big innovations are happening, and our idiots pluck out the drawings and the technical details."
"I assume the money this brings in doesn't always end up in the state coffers."
"It's worse than that, buddy. If you do this sort of thing as a state employee, you make yourself very vulnerable, especially because Ekewald and his gang are also helping major criminals. To be fair, at first they probably didn't know their clients were major criminals.
But that's what they were.
Damn right, and they took advantage, too. I could only dream of recruiting hackers at their level of expertise. The essence of this illegal business is to exploit information. So you can imagine, once they realized what our guys at the NSA were up to, these criminals knew they were sitting on a gold mine.
So they were in a position to blackmail.
Talk about having the upper hand. Our guys haven't just been stealing from large corporations. They've also plundered small family businesses and solo entrepreneurs who are struggling to survive. It wouldn't look too good if everything came out. So as a result, the NSA is forced to help not just Echovolt and Solifon, but also the criminals.
You mean the spiders?
You got it. Maybe for a while everyone stays happy. It's big business and the money's rolling in. But then a little genius pops up in the middle of the action, a certain Professor Balder. And he's just as good at ferreting around as he is at doing everything else. So he finds out about this scheme, or at least part of it. Then, of course, everyone's scared shitless and decides that something has to be done. I'm not entirely clear on how these decisions got made. I'm guessing our guys hoped legal threats would be enough. But when you're in bed with a bunch of criminals... The spiders prefer violence. They probably drew our guys into a plan at a late stage, just to bind them in even more tightly.
Jesus.
I would never have gotten to know any of this if we hadn't been hacked, said Needham.
Another reason to leave the hacker in peace.
Which is exactly what I'm going to do, so long as she tells me how she did it.
I don't know how much your promises are worth, but there's another thing I've been wondering about, Blomqvist went on.
Shoot!
You mentioned two guys, Barclay and Abbott. Are you sure it stops with them? Who's their boss?
I can't give you his name, unfortunately. It's classified.
I suppose I'll have to live with that.
You will,
Needham said inflexibly. At that moment, Blomqvist noticed that traffic was starting to flow again.
Chapter 28 November 24th Afternoon. Professor Edelman was standing in the parking lot at the Karolinska Institute, wondering what in heaven's name he had let himself in for. He was embarking on an arrangement which would mean his having to cancel a whole series of meetings, lectures, and conferences. Even so, he felt strangely elated. He had been entranced not just by the boy, but also by the young woman, who looked as if she had come straight from a street brawl, but who drove a brand new BMW, and spoke with chilling authority. He had barely been aware of what he was doing when he said, "Yes, sure. Why not?" to her questions, although it was obviously rash. The only grain of independence he had shown was to have declined all offers of compensation. He was going to pay his own travel and hotel expenses, he said. He must have felt guilty, but he was moved to take the boy under his wing, and his scientific curiosity was piqued. A savant who both drew with photographic exactitude and could perform prime number factorization... How absolutely riveting. To his own surprise, he even decided to skip the Nobel Prize dinner. The young woman had made him take leave of his senses. Hanna Balder was sitting in the kitchen on Torsgatan, smoking. It felt as if she had done little else aside from sit there and puff away, with a pit in her stomach. She had been given an unusual amount of support, but she had also been getting an unusual amount of physical abuse. Lasse Westman could not handle her anxiety. It detracted from his own martyrdom. He was always flying into a rage and yelling,
"Can't you even keep track of your own brat?"
Often he lashed out with his fists or threw her across the apartment like a rag doll. Now he would probably go crazy. She had spilled coffee all over the Dagens Nyheter culture section, and Lasse was already worked up because of a theatre review he found too sympathetic to actors he did not like.
"What the hell have you done?"
"I'm sorry," she said quickly. "I'll wipe it up."
She could tell from the set of his mouth, even before he knew it himself, that he would hit her, and she was so well prepared for his slap that she did not say one word, or even move her head. She could feel the tears welling up and her heart pounding, but actually that had nothing to do with the blow. That morning she had received a call which was so perplexing that she hardly understood it. August had been found, had disappeared again, and was probably unharmed. Probably. It was impossible for Hannah to know if she should be more worried or less. Hours had gone by without further news.
Suddenly she got to her feet, no longer caring whether she would get another beating or not. She went into the living room and heard Lasse panting behind her. August's drawing paper was still lying on the floor, and an ambulance was wailing outside. She heard footsteps in the stairwell. Was someone on their way here? The doorbell rang.
"Don't open! It'll be some bloody journalist!" Lasse snapped.
Hannah did not want to open either. Still, she could not very well ignore it, could she? Perhaps the police wanted to interview her again, or maybe they had more information now. Good news or bad news? As she went to the door, she thought of Franz. She remembered how he had stood there saying that he had come for August. She remembered his eyes, and the fact that he had shaved off his beard, and her own longing for her old life before Lasse Westman, a time when the telephone rang and the job offers came flooding in, and fear had not yet set its claws into her. She opened the door with the safety chain on, and at first she saw nothing, just the lift door and the reddish-brown walls. Then a shock ran through her, and for a moment she could not believe it, but it really was August. His hair was a tangled mess, and his clothes were filthy. He was wearing a pair of sneakers much too big for him, and yet he looked at her with the same serious, impenetrable expression as ever. She would not have expected him to turn up on his own. But when she undid the safety chain, she gave a start. Next to August stood a cool young woman in a leather jacket, with scratch marks on her face and earth in her hair, glaring down at the floor. She had a large suitcase in her hand.
"I've come to give you back your son," she said, without looking up.
"Oh, my God," Hannah said.
"My God!"
That was all she managed to say. For a few seconds she was completely at a loss as she stood there in the doorway. Then her shoulders began to shake. She sank to her knees, and, forgetting that August hated to be hugged, she threw her arms around him, murmuring,
"My boy! My boy!"
until the tears came. The odd thing was, August not only let her do it, he also seemed on the verge of saying something, as if he had learned to talk on top of everything. But before he had the chance, Lasse was standing behind her.
"What the hell?" "Well, look who's here," he growled, as if he wanted to carry on with their fight.
But then he got a grip on himself. It was an impressive piece of acting, in a way. In the space of a second he began to radiate the presence which used to make women swoon.
"We get the kid delivered to our front doorstep," he said to the woman on the landing. "How convenient. Is he okay?"
"He's okay,"
the woman said in a strange monotone, and she walked into the apartment with her suitcase and her muddy boots.
"Just come right on in,"
Lasse said in an acid tone.
"I'm here to help you pack, Lasse."
This was such a strange reply that Hannah was convinced she had misheard. Lasse did not seem to understand either. He just stood there looking stupid, his mouth wide open.
"What did you say?"
"You're moving out."
"Is this some kind of joke?"
"Not at all. You're leaving this house. Right now. And you're not coming anywhere near August ever again. You've seen him for the last time."
"You must be insane."
"Actually, I'm being unusually generous. I was planning on throwing you down the stairs. But instead, I brought a suitcase. Thought I'd let you pack some shirts and pants."
"What kind of freak are you?"
Lasse shouted, both bewildered and beside himself with rage. He bore down on the woman with the full weight of his hostility, and Hannah wondered if he was going to take a swipe at her as well. But something stopped him. Maybe it was the woman's eyes, or possibly the fact that she did not react like anyone else would have done. Instead of backing off or looking frightened, she only smiled at him and handed him a few crumpled pieces of paper from an inside pocket.
"If ever you and your friend Roger should find yourselves missing August, you can always look at this. And remember," she said.
Lasse turned over the papers, confused. Then he screwed up his face in horror, and Hannah took a quick look herself. They were drawings, and the top one was of Lasse. Lasse swinging his fists and looking profoundly evil. Later she would hardly be able to explain it. It was not just that she now understood what had been going on when August had been alone at home with Lasse and Roger. She also saw her own life more clearly and soberly than she had in years. Lasse had looked at her with exactly that twisted, livid face hundreds of times, most recently a minute ago.
She knew this was something no one should have to endure, neither she nor August, and she shrank back. At least she thought she did, because the woman looked at her with a new focus. Hannah eyed her uneasily. They seemed on some level to understand each other.
"Am I right, Hannah? He's got to go?"
the woman asked. The question was potentially lethal, and Hannah looked down at August's oversized shoes.
"What are those shoes he's wearing?"
"Mine."
"Why?"
"We left in a hurry this morning."
"And what have you been doing?"
"Hiding."
"I don't understand,"
she began, but got no further. Lasse grabbed hold of her violently.
"Why don't you tell this psychopath that the only one who's leaving is her?"
he roared. Anna cowered, but then it may have been something to do with the expression on Lasse's face, or the sense of something implacable in the young woman's bearing. Anna heard herself say,
"You're leaving, Lasse, and don't ever come back."
It was as if someone else was speaking in her place. After that, things moved quickly. Lasse raised his hand to strike her, but no blow came, not from him. The young woman reacted with lightning speed and hit him in the face, two, three times, like a trained boxer, felling him with a kick to the leg.
"What the hell?"
was all he was able to say. He crashed to the floor, and the young woman stood over him. Anna realized how long and how desperately she had wished Lasse Westman out of her life. Boblansky longed to see Rabbi Goldman. He also longed for some of Modig's orange chocolate, for his new duck's bed, and for springtime. But right now it was his job to get some order into this investigation. It was true that on one level he was satisfied. August Balder was said to be unharmed and on his way home to his mother. Thanks to the boy himself and to Lisbeth Salander, his father's killer had been arrested, even though it was far from certain that he would survive his injuries. He was in intensive care at Danderud Hospital. He was called Boris Latvinov, but had for some time been using the name Jan Holzer. He was a former elite soldier from the Soviet Army, a major, and his name had cropped up in the past in several murder investigations. But he had never been convicted. He had his own business in the security industry, and was both a Finnish and Russian citizen, and a resident of Helsinki. No doubt someone had doctored his government records. The other two people who had been found at the summer house on Ingaru had been identified by their fingerprints. Dennis Vilton, an old gangster from Svavelshire MC who had done time for both aggravated robbery and assault, and Vladimir Orlov, a Russian with a criminal record in Germany for procuring, whose two wives had died in unexplained circumstances. None of the men had yet said a word about what happened, or about anything at all. Nor did Boblansky hold out much hope that this would change. Men like that tend to hold their tongues in police interviews. But then those were the rules of the game. What Boblansky was unhappy about, though, was the feeling that these three men were no more than foot soldiers, and that there was a leadership above them linked to the upper echelons of society in both Russia and in the United States. He had no problem with a journalist knowing more about his investigation than he did. In that respect, he was not proud. He just wanted to move ahead, and was grateful for all information, whatever its source. But Blomqvist's discerning approach to the case had pointed out their own shortcomings, and reminded Boblansky of the leak and the dangers to which the boy had been exposed because of them. On this score his anger would never subside, and perhaps that explains why he was so irritated at Helena Kraft's eager efforts to get hold of him. And the head of SEPO was not the only one. The IT people at the National Criminal Police were also after him, as were Chief Prosecutor Richard Ekstrom and a Stanford professor by the name of Stephen Warburton from the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, who wanted to talk about a significant risk, as Amanda Flodd put it. That bothered Boblansky, along with a thousand other things, and there was someone knocking at his door. It was Modig, who looked tired and was wearing no makeup, revealing something different about her face.
"All three prisoners are having surgery," she said. "It'll be a while before we can question them again."
"Trying to question them, you mean?"
"I did manage to have a brief word with Latvinov. He was conscious for a while before his operation."
"Did he say anything?"
"Just that he wanted to talk to a priest."
"How come all lunatics and murderers are religious these days?"
"While all sensible old chief inspectors doubt the existence of their god, you mean?"
"Now, now."
"Latvinov also seemed dejected, and that's a good sign, I think," Modig said.
When I showed him the drawing, he waved it away with a resigned expression.
So he didn't try to claim it was a fabrication?
He just closed his eyes and started to talk about his priest.
Have you discovered what this American professor wants? The one who keeps calling?